Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. November Examination Series, 2018. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. How long did it take the man to finish the race? B. Who did he run with during the final section?
So how did you get on in the race? You must be exhausted.
Actually, I feel okay at the moment. I'm really pleased with my time. I was aiming to finish in 50 minutes, and in fact, I managed 43 minutes. That's my personal best.
Well done, that's fantastic. Did you run with anyone else?
I did most of it on my own this time. But towards the end, I ran alongside my trainer. We crossed the finishing line together.
And what about your friend, you know, the singer? I can't remember his name.
John. I started out with him, but he's a bit slower than me.
So how did you get on in the race? You must be exhausted.
Actually, I feel okay at the moment. I'm really pleased with my time. I was aiming to finish in 50 minutes, and in fact, I managed 43 minutes. That's my personal best.
Well done, that's fantastic. Did you run with anyone else?
I did most of it on my own this time. But towards the end, I ran alongside my trainer. We crossed the finishing line together.
And what about your friend, you know, the singer? I can't remember his name.
John. I started out with him, but he's a bit slower than me.
Question 2. A. Which tour did the woman go on? B. What was the area where she lives now originally called?
Hi, it's Betty here. I just wanted to say thanks for telling me about the guided tours of my area. I went on the history one this morning, and it was so interesting. I'd love to go on the nature tour as well sometime. If you're free, maybe we could go together. Anyway, I found out all sorts. Like, you know, the part of the town where I live now, we call it Castle Hill. Well, in the past it was known as Little Russia, because of all the people who moved here. I bet you didn't know that. So call me and I'll tell you more. Bye! Hi, it's Betty here. I just wanted to say thanks for telling me about the guided tours of my area. I went on the history one this morning, and it was so interesting. I'd love to go on the nature tour as well sometime. If you're free, maybe we could go together. Anyway, I found out all sorts. Like, you know, the part of the town where I live now, we call it Castle Hill. Well, in the past it was known as Little Russia, because of all the people who moved here. I bet you didn't know that. So call me and I'll tell you more. Bye!
Question 3. A. Which code do you need to get a free magazine? B. Where can you currently collect vouchers for cheap meals?
There's a new magazine out this month, and if you haven't got a copy yet, you'd better hurry. City Lights tells you where to go, what to wear, what's on, and a whole lot more. Get a year's worth of half-price magazines if you order online with the code TOP50, or use July 10 to get 1 month's issue without having to pay anything. And if you fancy an evening out with friends, there's a discount available at several restaurants in town. All you need to do is get 4 vouchers. They'll be giving them away in cinemas at the end of this week, or pop into a supermarket today. There's a new magazine out this month, and if you haven't got a copy yet, you'd better hurry. City Lights tells you where to go, what to wear, what's on, and a whole lot more. Get a year's worth of half-price magazines if you order online with the code TOP50, or use July 10 to get 1 month's issue without having to pay anything. And if you fancy an evening out with friends, there's a discount available at several restaurants in town. All you need to do is get 4 vouchers. They'll be giving them away in cinemas at the end of this week, or pop into a supermarket today.
Question 4. A. Which book does the woman decide to buy? B. What is she going to do next?
Can you see my shopping list anywhere? I'm going into town to get the last few things for my holiday.
Here it is, under the newspaper. Did you note down those 2 books you were interested in? What were the titles? Oh, yes, Rock Climbing and Coastal Walks.
I'm just going to get the first of them. I can't carry both in my rucksack.
Good idea. And while you've got the computer on, don't forget you need to print your ticket.
Yes, I'll do that, but I must buy insurance before anything else. I should have done that ages ago. Can you see my shopping list anywhere? I'm going into town to get the last few things for my holiday.
Here it is, under the newspaper. Did you note down those 2 books you were interested in? What were the titles? Oh, yes, Rock Climbing and Coastal Walks.
I'm just going to get the first of them. I can't carry both in my rucksack.
Good idea. And while you've got the computer on, don't forget you need to print your ticket.
Yes, I'll do that. But I must buy insurance before anything else. I should have done that ages ago.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by a student about a race he is going to take part in. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words or a number in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
For my presentation today, I'm going to tell you about a race that I've decided to take part in next year. It's organised by a group called Wings for Life. This is a charity which raises money for research to help people who've damaged their spine. That's the bones in your back. Lots of these people can't walk as a result of spinal injury, but this charity thinks that research will come up with a cure in the future. Anyway, Wings for Life raises money by organising what they called a world run. They call it this because the race takes place in several different places around the world at exactly the same time. This race isn't like other races, though, in that there isn't a finish line. It sounds a strange idea, but what actually happens is that everyone starts running, just like in a normal race. Then, 30 minutes later, a vehicle sets off. It's driven slowly, but gradually it reaches the slowest runners. As it overtakes each person, they have to stop running. That's why it's called the catcher car. And the final runner, which the car overtakes, is the winner. Wings for Life organised their first world run back in May 2014. That year, Races were held in 34 different locations on 6 continents, so this was across a total of 13 time zones. When the clock struck at the same hour across the world, every race started at exactly the same moment. This meant that, for example, the race in Australia started very late in the evening, whereas the race in California started very early in the morning. In 2014, the person who ran for the longest was a 29-year-old man called Lemuel Ketema. He was racing in Austria, although he is originally from Ethiopia. He managed to run almost 79 kilometres before he was overtaken, which was just over 5 hours after the start of the race. And some other interesting statistics are that the oldest person to take part was 95 years old. Women made up 42% of all the people taking part, and 58% were male. The organisation has a really good website, which I recommend you take a look at later. The address is wingsforlifeworldrun.com, and it gives you all sorts of information, including a speed calculator to see how far or how fast you're likely to run, and a map of each race. There's also a section on the charity and the work it does, and of course there's information about entering the race if you want to take part, as well as what to do if you'd like to volunteer on the day of the race itself. They need plenty of people at each race to make sure the event goes smoothly, for example, to put up signs, provide information to the public, indicate the route to runners, and to pass them water and snacks during the race. The website also tells you how much entry fees are, and the great thing is that the charity gets 100% of this, because the administration costs are covered by another company which sponsors the event. So it's well worth supporting.
Now you will hear the talk again.
For my presentation today, I'm going to tell you about a race that I've decided to take part in next year. It's organised by a group called Wings for Life. This is a charity which raises money for research to help people who've damaged their spine. That's the bones in your back. Lots of these people can't walk as a result of spinal injury. But this charity thinks that research will come up with a cure in the future. Anyway, Wings for Life raises money by organising what they called a world run. They call it this because the race takes place in several different places around the world at exactly the same time. This race isn't like other races, though, in that there isn't a finish line. It sounds a strange idea, but what actually happens is that everyone starts running, just like in a normal race. Then, 30 minutes later, a vehicle sets off. It's driven slowly, but gradually it reaches the slowest runners. As it overtakes each person, they have to stop running. That's why it's called the catcher car. And the final runner, which the car overtakes, is the winner. Wings for Life organised their first world run back in May 2014. That year, races were held in 34 different locations on 6 continents, so this was across a total of 13 time zones. When the clock struck at the same hour across the world, every race started at exactly the same moment. This meant that, for example, the race in Australia started very late in the evening, whereas the race in California started very early in the morning. In 2014, the person who ran for the longest was a 29-year-old man called Lemuel Ketema. He was racing in Austria, although he is originally from Ethiopia. He managed to run almost 79 kilometres before he was overtaken, which was just over 5 hours after the start of the race. And some other interesting statistics are that the oldest person to take part was 95 years old. Women made up 42% of all the people taking part, and 58% were male. The organisation has a really good website, which I recommend you take a look at later. The address is wingsforlifeworldrun.com, and it gives you all sorts of information, including a speed calculator to see how far or how fast you're likely to run, and a map of each race. There's also a section on the charity and the work it does. And of course, there's information about entering the race if you want to take part, as well as what to do if you'd like to volunteer on the day of the race itself. They need plenty of people at each race to make sure the event goes smoothly. For example, to put up signs, provide information to the public, indicate the route to runners, and to pass them water and snacks during the race. The website also tells you how much entry fees are, and the great thing is that the charity gets 100% of this, because the administration costs are covered by another company which sponsors the event. So it's well worth supporting.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about whether it is better to attend live sporting events or to watch them on television. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I watch lots of sport on TV, but whenever I get the chance, I like to see a match live. Of course, on TV, you see the spectators enjoying themselves and hear them all cheering, but you have no idea what the sense of excitement is actually like unless you're in the middle of the crowd yourself. And it doesn't just start inside the stadium. The feeling builds up on the journey there, and while you're waiting to get in. All this just adds to the experience.
Speaker 2. I've only been to a few live events, a tennis championship once, and a couple of football matches at the local stadium. I know it costs quite a bit to get in and sometimes the tickets are all sold out anyway, but I don't mind saving up for something like this every now and then. The only thing is that it's hard to get a seat where you can see everything clearly. Perhaps that's the advantage of watching on TV. Speaker 3.
My dad started taking me to matches when I was 7. I love doing that with him. These days I quite often just go by myself. You don't feel like you're on your own when you're in the middle of the stadium, everyone wearing the same colour and all desperate to see your team score. Sometimes I ask my friends to come along, but they haven't done so yet. It's not that they support other teams, just that they say they prefer to watch matches at home.
Speaker 4.
I'm really into basketball and I love watching it live and on TV. The only drawback to watching matches at home is having to listen to people telling you what's going on. I can see that for myself. But there's nothing better than sitting down with a newspaper the day after you've seen a live match and finding out what the experts have to say, especially when they comment on something I didn't see or what happened behind the scenes, for example.
Speaker 5.
Last summer, my mum and dad took me to a tennis match. It was the finals and we had really good seats. We were lucky because we won the tickets in the competition. I guess they would have cost quite a lot if we'd had to buy them. The match was so exciting all the way through. Though what I often feel I can do without is having to wait forever to collect tickets and get in. And, of course, a few hours getting there and back as well.
Speaker 6.
I've been playing football since I was 11 and I love watching matches too, especially if the team from the town I come from is playing. They're my favourites, even though they hardly ever win. I've tried to persuade my housemates to come to matches with me, but they're all into the top league teams, so they're not interested. We all get together as a group to watch matches at home on TV, though. We pretend that we're actually in the stadium and have a great time, whoever's playing.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I watch lots of sport on TV, but whenever I get the chance, I like to see a match live. Of course, on TV, you see the spectators enjoying themselves and hear them all cheering, but you have no idea what the sense of excitement is actually like unless you're in the middle of the crowd yourself. And it doesn't just start inside the stadium. The feeling builds up on the journey there, and while you're waiting to get in. All this just adds to the experience.
Speaker 2. I've only been to a few live events, a tennis championship once, and a couple of football matches at the local stadium. I know it costs quite a bit to get in and sometimes the tickets are all sold out anyway, but I don't mind saving up for something like this every now and then. The only thing is that it's hard to get a seat where you can see everything clearly. Perhaps that's the advantage of watching on TV. Speaker 3.
My dad started taking me to matches when I was 7. I loved doing that with him. These days I quite often just go by myself. You don't feel like you're on your own when you're in the middle of the stadium, everyone wearing the same colour and all desperate to see your team score. Sometimes I ask my friends to come along, but they haven't done so yet. It's not that they support other teams, just that they say they prefer to watch matches at home.
Speaker 4.
I'm really into basketball and I love watching it live and on TV. The only drawback to watching matches at home is having to listen to people telling you what's going on. I can see that for myself. But there's nothing better than sitting down with a newspaper the day after you've seen a live match and finding out what the experts have to say, especially when they comment on something I didn't see or what happened behind the scenes, for example.
Speaker 5.
Last summer, my mum and dad took me to a tennis match. It was the finals and we had really good seats. We were lucky because we won the tickets in the competition. I guess they would have cost quite a lot if we'd had to buy them. The match was so exciting all the way through. Though what I often feel I can do without is having to wait forever to collect tickets and get in. And, of course, a few hours getting there and back as well.
Speaker 6.
I've been playing football since I was 11 and I love watching matches too, especially if the team from the town I come from is playing. They're my favourites, even though they hardly ever win. I've tried to persuade my housemates to come to matches with me, but they're all into the top league teams, so they're not interested. We all get together as a group to watch matches at home on TV, though. We pretend that we're actually in the stadium and have a great time, whoever's playing.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear a radio interview with a student called Jess, who is talking about summer work at a music festival called Valley Sounds. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking to different people about ideas for holiday work for students. Today we have Jess Cooper with us, and last summer she worked at a three-day music festival called Valley Sounds. Jess, tell us about the festival.
Well, for the past 5 years it's taken place on a lovely farm near the coast, although before that it was in a different location. The original site couldn't cope with the number of people. Apparently the festival has doubled in size since it began.
Is it easy to get a job there?
Lots of people want to work at the festival. It's very popular and the bands are great. What they do is ask you to pay the entry fee. Then you work 3 6-hour shifts. And after the last one, they give you back what you've paid. Perhaps job isn't the best word to describe it, as you don't get paid by the hour or anything like that. And you still have to buy all your food like everyone else.
So, how many people apply each year?
Oh, I think they get several hundred applications, and they select about 60 staff from them. You obviously need to have plenty of energy, but they're particularly keen to take on people who can explain things clearly, like giving advice if there's a problem, though it's important to be sociable too.
And do staff camp at the festival along with everyone else?
Yes. There are a few cabins that people can hire, but the vast majority camp for 3 or 4 nights. There are 2 main sites. Sheep Corner is a quieter one for families, and Tent City is nearer the main stage. Then there's Flower Hill, a separate area for staff and performers.
What advice would you give to anyone who wants to work there?
It's worth bringing something with you to make sure you don't damage your hearing, particularly if you'll be spending lots of time near the loudspeakers. I know some people worry about taking anything expensive with them, but there's a locker for each staff member in the main building, so that's not a problem. Oh, and you get a festival hat too, which is handy when it's really sunny and also when it rains.
So what kind of work do you do there?
Well, there are several information points on the site, and there have to be 2 people on each of these. For example, to give people directions. They have a big map on a board to show people where to go. And they collect anything that people want to send, then deliver it to the nearest postbox. They also have some spare festival guides, you know, listing what's on each day, to give away in case people lose the ones they were given at the entrance.
Talking of losing things, I bet that happens a lot.
It's amazing how much stuff ends up in the lost property room. Lots of people come and check if they've lost something, or they email after the festival. But apparently, even after 3 months, there's masses remaining. So that's donated to a local organisation, which sells it and uses the money to fund environmental projects. Some people assume that festival staff can keep lost property, but that's not the case.
Jess, we've only got time for one more question. So, what's the highlight of the festival for you?
Well, of course, the music is a big part of it. There are always some groups you haven't seen before, and there's plenty to do as well. Like last year, I went to a workshop on circus skills, something I'd always wanted to try out. But nothing beats the chance to make friends. I've kept in touch with most of the group I was working with last year.
Well, I hope you enjoy the festival this summer, and thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking to different people about ideas for holiday work for students. Today we have Jess Cooper with us, and last summer she worked at a three-day music festival called Valley Sounds. Jess, tell us about the festival.
Well, for the past 5 years, it's taken place on a lovely farm near the coast, although before that it was in a different location. The original site couldn't cope with the number of people. Apparently, the festival has doubled in size since it began.
Is it easy to get a job there?
Lots of people want to work at the festival. It's very popular and the bands are great. What they do is ask you to pay the entry fee. Then you work 3 6-hour shifts. And after the last one, they give you back what you've paid. Perhaps job isn't the best word to describe it, as you don't get paid by the hour or anything like that. And you still have to buy all your food like everyone else.
So, how many people apply each year?
Oh, I think they get several hundred applications, and they select about 60 staff from them. You obviously need to have plenty of energy, but they're particularly keen to take on people who can explain things clearly, like giving advice if there's a problem, though it's important to be sociable too.
And do staff camp at the festival, along with everyone else?
Yes. There are a few cabins that people can hire, but the vast majority camp for 3 or 4 nights. There are 2 main sites. Sheep Corner is a quieter one for families, and Tent City is nearer the main stage. Then there's Flower Hill, a separate area for staff and performers.
What advice would you give to anyone who wants to work there?
It's worth bringing something with you to make sure you don't damage your hearing, particularly if you'll be spending lots of time near the loudspeakers. I know some people worry about taking anything expensive with them, but there's a locker for each staff member in the main building, so that's not a problem. Oh, and you get a festival hat too, which is handy when it's really sunny and also when it rains.
So what kind of work do you do there?
Well, there are several information points on the site, and there have to be 2 people on each of these, for example, to give people directions. They have a big map on a board to show people where to go. And they collect anything that people want to send, then deliver it to the nearest postbox. They also have some spare festival guides, you know, listing what's on each day, to give away in case people lose the ones they were given at the entrance.
Talking of losing things, I bet that happens a lot.
It's amazing how much stuff ends up in the lost property room. Lots of people come and check if they've lost something, or they email after the festival. But apparently, even after 3 months, there's masses remaining. So that's donated to a local organisation, which sells it and uses the money to fund environmental projects. Some people assume that festival staff can keep lost property, but that's not the case.
Jess, we've only got time for one more question. So, what's the highlight of the festival for you?
Well, of course, the music is a big part of it. There are always some groups you haven't seen before, and there's plenty to do as well. Like last year, I went to a workshop on circus skills, something I'd always wanted to try out. But nothing beats the chance to make friends. I've kept in touch with most of the group I was working with last year.
Well, I hope you enjoy the festival this summer, And thank you for telling us about it.
Thank you.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8, Part A. You will hear an IT lecturer giving a talk about data centres, which are places where electronic information is stored. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
Welcome to the first lecture of this new module on data management. Before we begin, I'd like you to consider how many electronic messages you send each day and how many photographs you upload to social media. Then think about large organisations which produce huge amounts of electronic data. The places where all this information is stored are called data centres. These buildings can be enormous as they house vast computer systems as well as backup power supplies and environmental controls, all of which most visitors would expect. What strikes you when you first walk into a data centre is the overwhelming noise generated by all of this. Not that many people get to visit these places. The design of new data centres is big business. The layout should be planned with IT requirements in mind, but a data centre needs to be energy and cost efficient, as well as accessible. For it to be future-proof, a range of possible scenarios has to be taken into account, such as the need for expansion. One solution is to make sure that an extra floor could be added if required, or to be able to add extra sections to the main building using the existing power supplies. Designers are also coming up with mobile data centres, which can be installed in a very short space of time in the event of a disaster. This is particularly important for large organisations which can't risk closure and need to minimise the possibility of disruption to their day-to-day functioning. A data centre can be very expensive to run, partly because it requires a lot of power, but also due to staffing costs. One solution has been to reduce or eliminate the need for people on site unless there are extraordinary circumstances. This means it can be operated in darkness, which is why it's known as a lights-out data centre. Such buildings are managed by remote systems and can be located further away from population centres, which also helps to keep costs down. Nowadays, several companies are building data centres in the far north, even in the Arctic, where the air is obviously very cold. This is really advantageous because it means relying less on air conditioning. Not only is this very efficient, but it also greatly reduces power consumption, so it's an attractive proposition for future investors.
Now you will hear the talk again.
Welcome to the first lecture of this new module on data management. Before we begin, I'd like you to consider how many electronic messages you send each day and how many photographs you upload to social media. Then think about large organisations which produce huge amounts of electronic data. The places where all this information is stored are called data centres. These buildings can be enormous as they house vast computer systems as well as backup power supplies and environmental controls, all of which most visitors would expect. What strikes you when you first walk into a data centre is the overwhelming noise generated by all of this. Not that many people get to visit these places. The design of new data centres is big business. The layout should be planned with IT requirements in mind, but a data centre needs to be energy and cost efficient, as well as accessible. For it to be future-proof, a range of possible scenarios has to be taken into account, such as the need for expansion. One solution is to make sure that an extra floor could be added if required, or to be able to add extra sections to the main building using the existing power supplies. Designers are also coming up with mobile data centres, which can be installed in a very short space of time in the event of a disaster. This is particularly important for large organisations which can't risk closure and need to minimise the possibility of disruption to their day-to-day functioning. A data centre can be very expensive to run, partly because it requires a lot of power, but also due to staffing costs. One solution has been to reduce or eliminate the need for people on site unless there are extraordinary circumstances. This means it can be operated in darkness, which is why it's known as a lights-out data centre. Such buildings are managed by remote systems and can be located further away from population centres, which also helps to keep costs down. Nowadays, several companies are building data centres in the far north, even in the Arctic, where the air is obviously very cold. This is really advantageous because it means relying less on air conditioning. Not only is this very efficient, but it also greatly reduces power consumption, so it's an attractive proposition for future investors.
Question 8, Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about where data centres are located and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
Hi, Nadia. Have you done the homework on data centres yet?
Oh, yes, I did it yesterday. I read quite a bit about ones in northern Sweden. It seems to be quite a popular location.
That's funny. I looked into the same area. Actually, I hadn't realised that so much has to be taken into account when choosing where to build a data centre. I mean, the weather and having access to electricity supplies are obvious, but I hadn't thought about things like flight paths and what the land surrounding the proposed plot is being used for.
I know. But if a company is going to invest so much in a new facility, they have to be sure it's in the right place. It seems that northern Sweden ticks many of these boxes, though. Plus, its stability, in geological terms, is satisfactory. I mean, there's hardly any chance of earthquakes, and security is excellent too.
And, as I said before, electricity supplies are vital. I read that about a century ago, Sweden began building hydroelectric dams to generate energy for its steel, iron and paper industries. And apart from the first of these, they have more or less closed down now, leaving the north of Sweden with plentiful supplies of electricity.
And that, in turn, means it's cheap.
Exactly.
So now, several different large companies have established data centres in northern Sweden. I read that one result of this is what's referred to as reverse migration. So, in the past, people moved from the north, which was quite sparsely populated, to the south, where it's milder and there were better job opportunities. Now the flow is in the other direction.
That's interesting. You wouldn't imagine people being attracted to living in the Arctic.
I know. And the actual data centres just look like huge grey warehouses from the outside. Here, look at this picture of one that's just been built. I wouldn't want to work there.
But look at that enormous fence all the way around it. You can tell there's something important inside with that sort of protection.
But it's not to deter spies or stop vandals getting in. There'll be some fairly sophisticated safety measures in the building, I'm sure. It's actually just to prevent wildlife from getting too close.
Oh, right.
Anyway, look at the time. We've got to get to our next lecture.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
Hi, Nadia. Have you done the homework on data centres yet?
Oh, yes, I did it yesterday. I read quite a bit about ones in northern Sweden. It seems to be quite a popular location.
That's funny. I looked into the same area. Actually, I hadn't realised that so much has to be taken into account when choosing where to build a data centre. I mean, the weather and having access to electricity supplies are obvious, but I hadn't thought about things like flight paths and what the land surrounding the proposed plot is being used for.
I know, but if a company's going to invest so much in a new facility, they have to be sure it's in the right place. It seems that northern Sweden ticks many of these boxes, though. Plus, its stability, in geological terms, is satisfactory. I mean, there's hardly any chance of earthquakes, and security is excellent too.
And, as I said before, electricity supplies are vital. I read that about a century ago, Sweden began building hydroelectric dams to generate energy for its steel, iron and paper industries. And apart from the first of these, they have more or less closed down now, leaving the north of Sweden with plentiful supplies of electricity.
And that, in turn, means it's cheap.
Exactly.
So now, several different large companies have established data centres in northern Sweden. I read that one result of this is what's referred to as reverse migration. So, in the past, people moved from the north, which was quite sparsely populated, to the south, where it's milder and there were better job opportunities. Now the flow is in the other direction.
That's interesting. You wouldn't imagine people being attracted to living in the Arctic.
I know. And the actual data centres just look like huge grey warehouses from the outside. Here, look at this picture of one that's just been built. I wouldn't want to work there.
But look at that enormous fence all the way around it. You can tell there's something important inside with that sort of protection.
But it's not to deter spies or stop vandals getting in. There'll be some fairly sophisticated safety measures in the building, I'm sure. It's actually just to prevent wildlife from getting too close.
Oh, right.
Anyway, look at the time. We've got to get to our next lecture.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.